The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Struck by the initial jobless claims, just that basic headline number coming in worse than expected, indicating that there is that ongoing wave of layoffs in the wake of the increase in virus cases. Does that stand out to you as the number of the morning?
It does. It's the one that tells us what's happened most recently in the economy. And if you look at the overall release from the Department of Labor, the total number of people who are now getting benefits of one form or another for unemployment is 31,491,000. That's up from 30,574,000 the week prior.
The director of the CDC telling Americans the worst is yet to come.
I do think the fall and the winter of 2020 and 2021 are going to be probably one of the most difficult times that we've experienced in American public health because of what you said, the co-occurrence of COVID and influenza.
The warning coming as public health officials say Miami is now the country's epicenter for the coronavirus. The positivity rate here, 28%, one of the highest in the nation. On Tuesday, Florida setting a new record for coronavirus deaths, 132 in a single day. In the last week, 17 more states and Washington, D.C. saw cases of new infections spike over 50%. In California, record numbers of new cases and hospitalizations. In Michigan, a packed house party over 4th of July weekend led to 43 infections and 66 additional exposures. Now some regions are taking drastic measures. Philadelphia banning events of more than 50 people until March 2021. And at New York airports, visitors coming in from 22 states designated as COVID hotspots now need to fill out forms from the health department and agree to a two-week quarantine or face a $2,000 fine. This as health experts warn that getting the virus may not give you immunity in the future.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Markets head higher this week on hopes for new stimulus and a possible cure for COVID. But looking deeper into the numbers, we are seeing new signs of weakness, especially on the job front. Congress is working on a multi-trillion dollar stimulus package that they hope to pass by the end of July or August in an effort to counter economic weakness caused by these government shutdowns of the economy. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up on the top of the hour, my good friend Ralph Ancampora joins me on the program. Ralph thinks the market is now going through a rotation out of those high-flying tech stocks and into other sectors of the market, which he says represents value and is actually healthy. The good news for investors is stocks are still in a bull market, and Ralph sees stocks heading higher. Then following Ralph, an extended interview with Jim Bianco from Bianco Research. Jim's theme is COVID plus stimulus equals inflation. As we take a deep dive into the economy, the Fed, and government policy as to its impact on the markets. Jim agrees with Ralph, as long as we have no inflation, these stock markets are headed higher. But my goodness, watch out for inflation, which could be the big story coming up in 2021. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. The key element to this week's trading was rotation, as well as the news that the S&P 500 has finally broken out above the June 8th high. That puts February highs within reach, and if we did that, essentially erasing COVID from the financial markets. And the end of the recession? Question? In a technical analysis, you know, they teach you that the probability of retracing all of a move, so all of the move down that we had back in March, that's what we've been doing since then on that rally, goes up considerably after you've retraced more than 60%. And we've done that. So the chances are pretty high. We'll have to continue to watch the economic indicators to know more, but most readings continue to improve. minus consumer sentiment this week, which took a dip in June due to the resurgence of COVID. Recent rollbacks in activity in California and Texas have not been taken into account due to the changes happening in July. So I think economic news will be important to track and the market's response to that news in coming weeks as those rollbacks finally hit those economic reports. The real reason I say that is because California, Texas, and Florida make up 29% of U.S. GDP and 27% of the population. A pretty cool website to track how the economy is doing through COVID is trackTheRecovery.org from Opportunity Insights, which is based at Harvard University. Data there shows a pretty decent drop-off in small business revenue since late June as COVID increases in those states I mentioned. And on that note, the market was hit on Monday when San Diego and Los Angeles announced the 2020-2021 public school year will be online only. And that's going to be interesting for parents that need to stay at home to take care of their children. That means that they're not at maybe offices and other businesses that are reopened, hopefully down the line. Additionally, California Governor Newsom added additional rollback steps to the to sort of stem the rise of COVID, which has been growing exponentially in those areas. And these stricter measures were for 29 counties accounting for 80% of the population in California. Many of the industries now closed again are still open for outdoor operations. Very interesting little loophole there. And restaurants can do takeout. I won't go into all of the different businesses that are being shut down, but to me, it feels like we've just rolled back to where things were back in March for those counties. For the rest of the week, we've largely seen a rotation out of momentum. That's the first thing I start off with this wrap up today is that we're seeing rotation out of momentum, out of growth, and out of mega cap names. A lot of profit taking going on there this week, which were outperformers as the market has been rallying up until now. Just reviewing some of those bellwether stocks, last I checked at the close, Amazon was down 7.4%, Alphabet was down 1.6% for the week, Microsoft down 5% for the week, Tesla down 2.9, almost 3, Salesforce down 5.6%, and Netflix was down 10% post earnings, which were announced on Thursday night. But Apple, one of the shining mega cap names, up 0.4%. So where's the money going? To the sidelines or maybe somewhere else? It's going back into other stocks, which is good. It's not going to the sidelines. So looking at the S&P 500 sectors, some of the best performers were healthcare, up 5% on the week. Utilities sector was up a little more than 4% this week, and then staples were up 2%. So, you know, the money is going somewhere. It's not going to cash, not going to treasuries. So again, out of high performers, out of the mega cap stocks into smaller cap. But like I said, really not going to the sidelines, which is healthy for the stock market. Moderna had good results in a small study that was announced this week, and there have been reports that more vaccine news is on its way. As you, many of you know, many are in their trials, second stage trials and third stage trials for a few. Any positive vaccine news tends to lend itself to benefit the sectors and industries hardest hit by COVID. So that's, you know, airlines, retail, and entertainment, basically. In earnings, the financials kick things off on Tuesday with news from Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, and Citigroup, with announcing very large provisions for credit losses, and were down after they announced, but Morgan Stanley, BlackRock, and Goldman Sachs were helped by robust performance from trading and has better stock responses overall to earnings because of it. And like I said last week, some of the momentum and growth tech names have been prized for perfection. And looking at Netflix's response to earnings on Friday after they announced on Thursday, it's clear what just happens to you when you don't hit perfection, and probably why profit taking took place in other names like Netflix in tech and growth names this week ahead of earnings. There will be a ton of names to announce earnings next week, but some of the notables are Halliburton in the morning and IBM in the afternoon Monday. Tuesday, Coca-Cola and UBS in the morning, United Airlines, TD Ameritrade, and Texas Instruments that afternoon. And then big ones, Tesla and Microsoft Wednesday that afternoon, and Universal Health on Thursday. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Back to you, Jim, with this week's technician, Ralph Akinpura. Let's see if he has anything to say about the rotation that we're seeing.
Countries around the globe are becoming more hierarchical, less dynamic, and more concentrated in wealth and power among a new progressive elite. Prospects for upward mobility for the middle and lower classes, however, continue to weaken, leading to greater polarization and a general erosion of the values necessary for the survival of a stable democratic society. Those at the top recognize this growing threat and are pinning their hopes on a radical mix of progressive policies and technological authoritarianism. There's a new book out that explores these issues and more. It's titled The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class, written by Joel Kotkin, who joins us today. Joel, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with what feudalism is and why it's making a comeback.
Well, feudalism, and obviously, you know, the feudalism we have today is not a bunch of guys going around in tights and wearing armor. What it is about a several characteristics that we're seeing return. One is hierarchy. Tremendous concentration of power in very few hands. That was one of the major parts of feudalism, and a basic lack of upward mobility for most people. Slow population growth, that was certainly part of the Middle Ages. I think the growth of sort of an apocalyptic, almost to the point sometimes of insanity, ideology, which, you know, sees the world coming to an end, very similar to what you had in the Middle Ages. The development of a censorious, I call in the book the clerisy, you know, a group of people, the media, academia, you know, the entertainment industry, which are completely dominated by one particular kind of ideology, and that anyone who dares differ, well, we don't burn them at the stake anymore, but we just cancel them. They go into non-existence. You know, somebody who made an inappropriate Facebook post 10 years ago can now be canceled for life. This is sort of a kind of thought control that we never saw. And one of the problems is technology allows for thought control to work more efficiently than it did in the Middle Ages. I mean, if somebody kept their thoughts to themselves, I guess you would be safe. And then what we're seeing is the end of the Middle Ages was driven by the rise of what I call the yeomanry, which is the small property-owning middle class, you know, the small investor, the small property owner, the small business person, the artisan. And these are the people who have been losing out for a while, and in the pandemic are getting clobbered particularly.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, just as we had a swift downtrip in the market beginning in the middle of February, and we've had a nice rise up, how long does this continue? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is Ralph Akinpour. Ralph, I want to begin with Dow theory, and I'd like to get your take, because if you look at the three major indexes that we all follow, the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, the Dow has been lagging the NASDAQ and the S&P. Is there any significance to that? And if there is, tell us about it.
First, to begin with, I believe that the March 23rd low was the bottom. Okay. I mean, we could talk about the VIX index was at near record levels up around 85, which was comparable to another major, major bottom in 2009. And then you had the number of stocks below the 200-day moving average, which is at practically, you know, everything was there. And so I'm in the camp of saying that that's where the market the new bull market started. Okay. And yes, you're right. The Dow has lagged, but I find it interesting because the NASDAQ, if you had a picture of the NASDAQ, you see it at all time new highs and everybody's happy. But what you're starting to see right now, as we have this conversation, is that I think there's rotation going on. You're going to start seeing the last couple of days, the Dow actually was holding up a little bit better than the NASDAQ, which is telling me that some money is coming out of the high flyers where the big profits have been in the last several months, but it's finding other places to go into. The laggards. And to me, that's the lifeline of every bull market, is the ability to rotate. So the lagging that you're talking about in the Dow, I think is going to play a game of catch up. And I wouldn't be surprised to see in the next couple of weeks, you'll have the Dow at an all-time new high.
Wow. That's quite a prediction. You know, you take a look at some of these valuations. Yep. I mean, I never thought in my lifetime I would see companies, what, just a couple of days ago, you had Apple and some of these big tech stocks. They were approaching market caps of almost $2 trillion. My goodness. If Amazon gets to $2 trillion, Jeff Bezos is going to be worth $300 billion. It reminds me of the Gilded Age, Ralph.
Yeah, the Gilded Age. Yes. In fact, I was telling you about the book I'm writing, and I'm on the chapter of the Gilded Age. And that's when we had a lot of inventions and people were making, you know, the wealthy were making so much money in this country. But it was a broad-based economic recovery for everybody. It was exciting times. I think we'll get back there. You know, I'm a big believer in this country will survive. It's tough times, granted. I mean, you can't minimize what the virus has done, and it continues to spike in certain places, and it's scary. Now we got the election coming up, and looks like Biden's got at least near term, he's got a pretty substantial lead. And then you have the riots in the cities. And, you know, so there's a lot of confusion. But having said all that, look at what the market has done. It's moved up. In the classic example that the market is a leading indicator. So I think it's telling us that, in the words of Winston Churchill, when you're walking through hell, keep walking.
You know, that's true. And that's probably one of the more difficult things to do when you're looking at the market. You're seeing things on television, the riots, the looting, you know, the COVID cases starting up again were several of the states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California were doing very well. Now, this is where the virus is most prominent. So that scares a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are surprised to see what they're hearing in the news every night.
Yep.
And then take a look at what the market's doing.
Yep.
But maybe the market is way ahead of all of us.
Well, the market usually, you know, not always, but it usually leads because it doesn't look backwards. It looks forward. And, you know, as a young analyst many, many years ago, the old timers used to tell me, Ralph, when you're writing a market letter, try to close your eyes and try to picture what the headlines in the newspaper are going to be 6 months from today. And I've always done that. You know, I'm looking out 6 months into, you know, early next year. And of course, the election will be behind us. But I have to assume that maybe we'll have a virus. We'll have a vaccine for the virus and kids will be back at school and things like that. So I'm optimistic longer term.
You know, what's amazing, Ralph, is when we go through periods like this and, you know, probably for many of us, at least in my adult life, I've never seen anything like what we're seeing now where, you know, we're quarantined and you've shut down a good portion of the economy. But the amazing thing about America is its resiliency, its entrepreneurship. And I'm sure as we come out of this, retail will change. Companies are adapting. You've seen this with Walmart and some of the bigger stores, even Best Buy. They're coming out with a stronger online presence. Restaurants will change. You know, it's funny. We decided to get some fast food the other night. And a friend and I, we went to Taco Bell. And Ralph, there was a line going out into the parking lot. I mean, there must have been 12, 15 cars standing in line. I'm saying, well, this business is good for them.
Yeah. People want to, you know, they want to get back to regular life. And you're right. I think we've learned a lot with communications and, you know, people are learning that, well, they could do a lot of work at home. you know, because of being forced with the virus. But yeah, things will change. We're going to be a different people. We're going to be thinking differently.
You know, as you look back over your career, and we've gone through these technological waves. I mean, you take a look at the 70s, the technology company that dominated the era from the 50s, 60s, and 70s was IBM. You know, they made computers, then they got into the personal computer business. Then you had a company come along like Apple and Microsoft. They changed things. Then you had Cisco, the internet. Then you had Amazon, all these companies. And you see these technological changes. I mean, you just look at, Ralph, the things that we have at our fingertips today.
Oh,
I mean, something
amazing.
Like Google. Look what that's done for research.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's amazing what we have today. I'm going to have to send you a picture of Ralph's first computer. That's what I call it. It's really not a computer. I found when we were moving out to Minnesota 10 years ago, I went up into the attic and I found a box that hadn't opened in 25 years. And what was in the box was my old war room. I had the famous war room in Wall Street. I worked for a firm called Kidder Peabody in 1980. And I had wall charts, hand plotted, that were 8 feet high, 22 feet long. I had four of them. And I had presence of mind 30 years ago to laminate them, so they were in great shape. And I have one of them hanging in my barn. And I have to send you that picture. And you'll see that we plotted every day the various averages and the oscillators and everything. And that's what we had years ago. And now you have it on your phone. I am so amazed at what we have done. But you know what? Doing it the old-fashioned way was still better.
Yeah, that's funny. I collect financial calculators. I still have the first calculator my mother gave me in college.
You're kidding.
And then all the calculators that I had during graduate school. So,
wow.
And you know what's funny? My favorite is the HP 12C. I think that came out in 1980. They're still selling it 30, 40
wow.
years later.
Isn't that cool?
I want to talk about something that you have been into and your wife has done this, and that's dividend stocks. Because, Ralph, if we look at where interest rates are, and I'd like to get your take on where 10-year treasuries are, what the charts are telling you, because the day you and I are speaking, the 10-year treasury note is 0.64. And today they announced for the first time 30-year mortgages got below 3%. I would never have thought in my lifetime I would see a 30-year mortgage below 3%.
Well, if you listen to what the Fed is saying, they're going to keep rates low for the next several years. So I think we're going to continue seeing very low rates for the foreseeable future. And looking at the graphs, I mean, I'd like to say they're bottoming out, and they're going to, but I'd say they're in a trading range, and they can remain relatively low for quite some time.
So speaking of yields, let's talk about the utility sector for a while. It's been lagging the markets. At one time, it was leading it. But, you know, you take a look at utility stocks, the average yield is over 3%. I mean, that's almost double what you could get in a 30-year treasury bond.
Oh, I look at the chart of the Dow Utility Index. It's been going literally flat trading range for the last 4 months. And you're right, it underperformed. But again, taking a look longer term, you have the benefits of better returns with utilities, and number one. And number two, I think that four-month consolidation phase for me is a real bottom in the graph. So technically, I think it's just the rotation I was mentioning before, which is very healthy for the market. You're going to start seeing the utilities in the not too distant future start picking up in momentum. And if they get above their March high, the Dow Utilities March high, June high was 849. And right now it's at 806. So I think you have a good shot of making a breakout here. So I'm encouraged with utilities. And in fact, I would be encouraging people to look at utilities. And speaking of sectors, in that category, I would put consumer discretionary, consumer staples. I think they're ready for new highs. Some of them are on the verge of making new highs. The XLB is materials. And I'm very bullish on gold and silver. They look very good. XLV is healthcare. They've been very, very neutral, kind of like the utilities, but I think they've bottomed. In other words, we were talking earlier about the rotation coming out of some of the recent leaders like the technology stocks. You know, I was getting a nosebleed looking at Tesla and things like that. I mean, they're up so far, so fast. I mean, that's great, but you're defying the laws of gravity. So you're going to see some profit taking there, but it's going to go into the ones that lagged. So utilities and healthcare is another one, XLV.
Yeah, I was just looking at the PE ratio of Tesla. It's almost 500.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost reminiscent of what we saw in the latter part of the 90s, where some of the PE ratios on those stocks were just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that you've been a big proponent of, as well as your wife, the nice thing about these big blue chip dividend stocks is you don't have to wait for the stock to get up because you're getting paid every quarter. And if you own a good one, not only that, you get a pay increase every year. So it's not a bad place to be when we're at 0.6% or 1.3% on treasury bonds and notes.
Yep. No, I agree. As you said, my lovely wife, Rosemary, was a stockbroker for many, many years, and her clients just loved her because she just locked them all into long-term returns, and they're all home now cutting coupons and enjoying the good life. And I recommend that you do some of your portfolio, especially long-term. Look at some of the names I was talking about.
So as you see this market, some of the areas that look really appealing to you, and you've, well, number one, you think there's a rotation.
Yep.
We've seen a pullback in some of the big names this week from Apple to Amazon. So utilities, staples, you like gold, you like staples. It sounds to me like almost a rotation into some defensive plays or things have been beaten up.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Not only beaten up, but they've recovered off their respective March lows, but they've gone in some cases literally sideways for 4 months. And I'm saying now that the technology, and I use that in a general term, is overextended and tired, and there'll be some profit taking in there. As long as the money stays in the market and rotates into areas that did not move up as dramatically, that to me is very, very healthy. And I see that happening. And a couple of other groups that I just noticed today breaking out on the upside is medical devices, and the symbol is IHI, and insurance, IAK, is starting to break out. That's a financial. So no, I like what I see. Be patient. We're going higher.
Okay. And Ralph, tell our listeners, because I mean, you and I have seen a lot of these cycles, and it's probably hard with the sentiment. It's kind of hard when you turn on the evening news and you see pictures or things occurring that aren't very pleasant, that it's hard to be positive, but the market always works its way through that. And if it's going higher, basically more than 90% of the time it's right. It's telling you things are going to improve.
Yes. Yeah. I mentioned early on that at the March 23rd low, the VIX index was at record highs. And there's your fear index. You combine that with the AAII, American Association Individual Investor poll of the sentiment of investors. They were very, very negative. So when I collect a lot of the sentiment indicators, you know, behavioral finance, that's part of what we technical analysts like to look at. And fear and greed, that's extremely important in the marketplace. And I think historically we were at levels that we hadn't seen in the past. If we did, it was very, very unusual, you know, at the crisis points like the 87 crash and the March lows of 2009, when we had real, real bearish sentiment. So I think the market has tested itself. It's been at those levels, and since then, we're slowly coming out of it. And granted, as you mentioned, you know, if you listen to the TV and you get all nervous, and one recommendation I give to everyone that's listening is just put the TV on mute, and you'll feel a hell of a lot better.
Just look at the pictures and don't listen.
Yes. Yeah.
So
that's what an old friend of mine said to me about technical analysis. I don't read the articles and I just look at the pictures.
Well, listen, Ralph, as we close, you're working on a project, which I'm kind of excited about, and you're going to send us some pictures and we'll see if we can put those up on the web. And that is about your barn and the book. And tell people, last time you had gone back to the Cowles Index, and you've got on your barn a chart of the Dow going back over 100 years. You've added some other features to your barn. Tell us about it.
Well, I have the entire history of the stock market and everything. And, you know, the Cowles Index, by the way, became the S&P 500 in 1957. A guy by the name of Alfred Cowles at Yale University wanted to go back and create as much history, market history, as he could. And the best that he could get was going, and he created, he and his research team, started in 1871 with the Cowles Index. And when I was starting to do I teach at St. Thomas University, and the dean wants me to write a book about all of that. I painted on my barn wall. I not only have the pictures of the market and what they've done every year, but I have all the U.S. presidents, have all the events that happened, all the recessions. It was all painted with lines and notations. And the last thing that I did, a very good friend of mine came up to me, and I was, because he had seen the wall many, many times, I invited him to come about a month ago. And I said, hey, you got to see, I put two new lines on. I said, I got gold and silver going back to 1857 plotted. And you got to see what happened to gold and silver during the Civil War, and then what happened right after the Depression of 29. It's absolutely fabulous. And he turns to me, he says, you're missing one thing. I said, what's that? He said, interest rates. Well, this week, guess what? I got the Fed funds going back to 1954, all up to date. And I'm going to send you that picture.
Oh, my goodness. And we'll put it up on the web. Well, listen, Ralph, as always, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Say hello to your lovely wife. Stay safe. And by the way, I want to let everybody know, Ralph is practicing social distancing in a very good way.
Me, the horses, and my friend Henry VIII. He's an English mastiff. He's my best friend, my dog, and he weighs 262 pounds.
Oh, my goodness. That's a big dog.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Joining us on the show today is John Butler. He's a consultant and contributor at MacroHive, which is an international economic and investing consultancy firm. And John, I know that you've been on a number of different adventures where you're located in London, so definitely good to have you back. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show is because of your expertise in what is probably an area that's not familiar to a lot of our listeners, but is something that I think is going to be coming up much more in discussion, especially if we start to see moves in this direction. There's been a lot of talk about it, and that is the subject of yield curve control. Now, for any of you listening where that sounds very arcane, John's going to break it down for us today and especially explain why this is going to be an important thing to understand when we think about the investment implications for all of our portfolios. So, John, if you would mind, tell us where yield curve control fits into the broader subject of central bankers' unconventional policies.
It actually has a long history. I don't want to bore people with too much of that history, but a little bit of it would be instructive. First of all, it's not a new idea. And indeed, the United States followed a policy of yield curve control in the aftermath of the Second World War, during which, of course, a huge national debt had been run up to finance the war. And it was agreed between the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve that U.S. government borrowing costs would be capped at 2.5%, which was seen at the time as a historically low level. And that yield curve capping, well, a form of yield curve control, of course, would facilitate paying down that accumulated debt. And indeed, that's precisely what happened. If you take a look at the post-war period, that debt was indeed paid down. And by the time you got to the Eisenhower administration, especially, I think, the latter stages of the Eisenhower administration, the U.S. government was no longer even running deficits. They were running surpluses again, largely as a result of having paid down enough of the debt such that the interest expense was no longer as high as it had previously been. And that all took place under an explicit yield curve control regime.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe. Just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Well, here we are. The economic news, at least in the short term, looks like the economy is improving. If that's the case, is that why the stock market is going up? And will it continue? Well, we're going to do a deep dive. Joining me on the program is Jim Bianco from Bianco Research. Jim, let's talk about two things that are going on in the market right now, two powerful forces which you've addressed recently. One is what's going on with the economy, and the other one is the fiscal monetary support. And you come to the conclusion, how does this play out? The answer is inflation. Let's begin with that.
Yeah, you've got two things going on in the economy at once, as you pointed out. The first one is that it seems to be plateauing. I want to call it the rehiring, the restarting of the economy. It has gone a long way, but it seems to have kind of stalled. Now, it's not reversing, but its rate of increase has definitely started to slow. Now, nominally, that would be bear risk markets. That would be problematic for, you know, your stock fund, but it hasn't been, because the other force that you have going is you've got money printing and you've got the government promising either bailouts or stimulus across the board. Now, that's a little open for debate as to whether or not we're going to get that by the end of the month, but the market is largely expecting that once you get through the histrionics of politics, that we will get some kind of extension on unemployment benefits, and we'll probably get some more stimulus as well, too. So those two forces are meeting. And I think what they're doing is they're resolving themselves that in the short term, it's definitely holding markets higher and will continue to probably hold markets higher, even though nominally the news is weakening. But longer term, I do think that all the economic fundamentals will win out. And the combination of a big unemployment rate, which means that you're producing less GDP, and to get people to spend money means less supply, means more demand, which means prices, which means inflation eventually returns. Now, it's not going to be a 2020 story. It might be a first half of 21 story, but I definitely think it is going to start to come back. But for the short term in markets, it is the money printing and it is the promises of bailouts and stimulus that seems to be driving them more than just about anything else right now.
Let's get into this inflation thesis, because when we came out of the financial crisis in 2009, there was a lot of money printing. The Fed's balance sheet went up to, what, $4.6 trillion. And we really didn't see the kind of inflation that we could possibly see now. I wonder if you would contrast, let's say, 2009 with the stimulus and the money printing to what we're seeing now. The thing that strikes me, Jim, is if you are shutting down businesses that produce things, shutting down businesses that provide services, and at the same time you're giving money to people to spend that we're creating, you're giving money to spend at the same time you're cutting supply, that's got to be inflationary.
Yeah, you're exactly right. In 2008, we had half of what I was talking about then. We had stimulus from the central bank in the form of quantitative easing. And I think it was correct to say that a lot of that stimulus kind of went into the financial system and stayed there. It never really manifested itself in more economic activity in terms of loans or corporate bond borrowing or things that would produce jobs in GDP. So you wound up with higher asset prices and you didn't wind up with more economy, if I could use if I could use those phrases for it. And they've learned from that lesson in 2008, which is why in 2020, you still had that push of money into the financial system to support financial assets. But now you've got the Fed buying corporate bonds, buying ETFs. You've got the government sending stimulus checks, $600 a week extra for unemployment, promises that we're going to bail out the energy industry, we're going to bail out the airline industry, we're going to bail out anybody else who needs a bailout. And that has shown up in a lot more economic activity. One of the things I've joked about, just to give one example, is if you look at the housing traffic and the housing numbers, they're pretty good, relatively speaking, right now. And I said, you know, I was always taught, probably like you, Jim, that, you know, income growth is what drives housing. When people have jobs and they get paid, they tend to spend money on houses. Little did I know that it would only take the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression to really get the housing market going because of all of that stimulus and all of that promise of stimulus that we've got going, so much so that people are saying, yeah, I don't want to live in an urban area because of the virus, so I'm going to move to a more rural area. Well, you're able to. You know, last I checked is if you lost your job, that you could wish anything you wanted, but you weren't necessarily going to move, but that's happening now. So that's what's different about this one, is that they did structure these programs with the PPP and a lot of other programs to kind of get money into the economy as opposed to leaving it in the financial system like they did in 2008.
In your latest piece, you talk about, you know, we've got what's going on with COVID and the economy, and then you've got this monetary and fiscal stimulus. And you go, the thing that ends this is inflation, and that's the bond market. What will cause the bond vigilantes to show up? Because as you talk about the typical things we would look at to measure inflation, like tips, break even, and in my opinion, the yield curve, a lot of this is being distorted by what the Fed is doing. Typically, for example, Jim, if you were to go into recession, you would see corporate bond yields widen, credit spreads widen because of the risk, which started to happen in February and March until the Fed announced it was going into the corporate bond market. So what would cause the vigilantes to show up?
You're right. Let me take that first part first, and that is the vigilantes. That's an old Ed Yardeni term that he coined in the early 80s. And what it means is, while I've talked about central banks and governments printing money, borrowing money to try and support markets, there is something bigger than them. And that's the collective of the financial markets. If the collective of the financial markets comes to a certain opinion, they can overwhelm it. Now, they're not of a certain opinion. They're of many different opinions. Some are bullish, some are bearish, some are in, some are out, some are left, some are right, up, down. And so therefore, in that disparate a bunch of opinions, the central bank is kind of pushing everything around. If you get that inflation where you have that reduction of supply, increase in demand, pushing higher prices, and the bond market in general comes to one collective idea, there is inflation. There is a loss of relative purchasing power. You don't want to own a fixed income security. They will sell. They will move out. They will overwhelm all of the activities of the central banks. And what's allowing the central banks and the federal government to get away with a lot of this activity is, as long as you keep promising to borrow, and as long as interest rates still stay at these historic lows, and people are willing to step up and buy your paper, you can get away with it until that changes. And that's inflation. Let me turn that question around real quick. What if I'm wrong? What if there isn't inflation? I still think it's profound. Keep in mind that between March and August next month, the federal government will borrow, or the central bank will print, the equivalent of about 4 years of tax receipts.
Wow.
If that doesn't produce, and in fact, in the general account, in the Treasury General Account, the Treasury General Account, TGA, there is $1.7 trillion in that account right now. That's almost 9 months of tax receipts. If you can borrow and print 4 years of tax receipts in 5 months, push markets up, get everybody's job back, return the economy to normal, then why, Jay Powell, do you keep saying, well, then we'll put these tools on the shelf? No, keep doing it forever. Why don't we just get rid of the IRS then at that point? What's the point of collecting taxes if you can print it up and borrow it in 5 months, 4 years worth, and not have a consequence. So either there will be a consequence of all of this inflation, which is what I think will happen, or if there isn't a consequence of this, we go full-blown MMT. That's what I was trying to explain, is then the question is, because MMT, the whole idea under MMT is that you hold interest rates steady around zero, I'm kind of summarizing it here, and as long as you don't have inflation, tax rates can fall, and tax rates go up and down like interest rates do now under MMT as a regulator of inflation. So if you don't have inflation, you can cut taxes. You could cut taxes dramatically because you don't need them. You can just borrow and print the money. So either way, you're going to have a profound effect out of this policy. Either it produces inflation, rates go up, there's a loss of confidence in central banks and governments. Hey, you guys are trying to hold everything together, but you can't. Or it works, and then you're not putting this on the shelf. This is going to become the way the world works from this point forward.
You know, that's interesting that you bring up MMT, because I'm reading The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kelton. And she said, basically, the government, her thesis under MMT, the government is different than you and I. As consumers, we have to balance our books. We can only spend what we bring in. But the government is different. They can print as much money as they want, until she does acknowledge that one thing we're talking about shows up, which is inflation, which then, under her scenario, you combat it by raising taxation. But let me ask you this. If you raise taxation as they're talking about in this political campaign, and you raise it on the people that produce and invest, isn't there a consequence to that to the economy?
There should be. I mean, there should be. If you get a Biden presidency and a Senate that goes to the Democrats and they push through taxes at that point, you know the old saying about that, if you raise the price of something, you get less of it. Well, going to raise the price of capital, or if you're going to raise the price of getting a job by taxing it, by taxing payroll taxes, you're going to get less of that, is what you're going to wind up with. And so that's going to be a big drag on the economy as we move forward. Now, that's assuming, of course, that we get a political outcome in November that opens the door for that. Right now, I'm not so sure Wall Street's really focused on that as much. I think they're beginning to focus on it. And when they do, I still think that the jury is still out. I know some, like Charlie Cook of the Cook Report and stuff, have pretty much decided that the election's over and Biden is going to win. Yes, Biden is leading, but I'm not so sure that I would go as far as to say that the election is over just yet.
You know, that's interesting, because it's always been my view from my experience that when the economy is growing, it can absorb a shock to the system. When the economy isn't growing, you have high unemployment, it is not healthy enough to absorb that shock. So let's just go forward and let's assume Cook is right, Biden wins, and he puts forth a $4 trillion tax increase. Do you think, Jim, he would actually go through with that? And the reason I'm saying that is Obama waited until his second term before he raised taxes. I think he held back because the economy was weak coming out of the financial crisis. If we have double-digit unemployment, and I want to get into this economic surprise and what's happening to small business next, but let's assume that we're at double-digit unemployment, and your research is showing that we flattened out or could be weakening again. If that's the case next year, are you really going to want to hit the economy with $4 trillion of new taxes? Would you hold off?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in 2020, I hate to say it, but a lot of these decisions are made by financial markets. You make a proposal to raise taxes, you make a proposal to do this or do that, increase spending or cut spending or whatever. I feel like a lot of what they do in Washington is they make these proposals and then they sit back and they watch the stock market for a month. If the stock market hears it, understands it, and keeps going up, then it's kind of giving us a green light to do it. The reason that Obama waited till the second term might be because, remember what the stock market did in the first few months of his presidency. It dove down to that March 2009 low and was perceived to be extraordinarily weak for the first couple of years of his presidency. So I have no doubt that Biden will propose the idea. If the markets bless it, I'm unfortunately going to tell you that I think it's going to happen. But if he proposes the ideas and the markets reject it, they sell off, it will table that idea. Unfortunately, it's going to have to come down to the markets having to punish in order to prevent it, which means then that investors are going to have to get punished in order to prevent it as well, too. But that's a lot of the way that a lot of stuff has been. I can't tell you how many policymakers that I've talked to or people that are policymaker-like, and you say, here's a proposal, and what do you think about this? And they, and their answer is essentially, well, the stock market went up, so it can't be that bad. Or the stock market went down and it's terrible, or something like that. Oh, I see. So that's how we're going to define whether or not this is a good job or a bad job. And that's a wrong, I think it's a wrong approach on it. But unfortunately, that's the world we live in right now.
I want to get back to economics, because I think this is going to shape a lot of what you and I will be talking about over the next year. And you get into the surprise index and the unemployment number. What I'm seeing here, as you're aware, California is now back into the shutdown mode. There's two strip malls near my house, Jim. And in the last 2 weeks, I've seen 10 businesses shut their doors. A restaurant that was an Italian restaurant we used to go to, in business with the family for 30 years, shut down, closing their doors. Let's talk about what this is doing to small business, number one. And number two, once they go out of business, how do you bring these businesses back? I mean, I just don't think you can get a stimulus check. They're going to reopen their doors and everything is going to be like it was before.
Yeah, that's going to be a real problem. OpenTable, the online reservation system, is now projecting that up to a third of restaurants in the United States are at risk of closing their doors in the next year. And that number is approaching 40% in New York City alone. So that's a lot of restaurants that are going to go out of business. Problem is that these businesses, small businesses, usually operate on a cash flow basis. As long as our sales are there and our money's coming in the door, we can pay our employees and we just continue to go along. They don't have the reserves or the capability of reserves to withstand or wait this out. The PPP loans was designed to do that. And they were on average giving people about 2.5 months worth of payroll. That ends about now. And according to the Department of Labor report that they put out a couple of weeks ago, they listed all the companies that got PPP loans. It adds up to about 32 million jobs, which are being supported by those loans. And that money is starting to run out right now. That's why what you're seeing in the economic data is that it is starting to plateau. And I'll give you one interesting statistic. There is the initial unemployment claims, there's a lot of noise in those numbers. And I think that the best way to look at this right now, because of the noise, is to look at the number of states that are reporting increases in unemployment from the previous week. Increases in unemployment claims. Last week was the first time since the pandemic we went over 25 states, 33 in fact, are now reporting higher claims than the previous week. Only 17 are reporting lower claims than the previous week. So all of a sudden, unemployment insurance looks like it's starting to plateau or bottom out, and we might start seeing a general rise in that. So a lot of these businesses are in trouble. They've lost too much money. They can't stay open. They can't meet their payrolls. They can't meet their rent. They can't meet whatever other services that they need to pay. The proprietors are not getting paid, but some of their employees might be getting paid. And then there's the other problem too with a lot of these businesses. University of Chicago says 68% of people on unemployment because of the extra $600 a week are now getting paid more than they did when they were working. And in fact, a quarter of them, or about a fifth of them, are getting twice as much as they did when they were working. So when some of these businesses, think landscaping and stuff, when they go back to work, their employees don't want to go back. I'm fine right here where I am. I'm making more money than I did working for you. And so now they have to bid up to get these employees to come back to work as well, too. This is a difficult situation for the economy. And I would go as far to say it doesn't get fixed with a virus. I mean, excuse me, with a vaccine for the virus. If I could snap my fingers and say, right now we have a vaccine, I think a lot of these businesses are just destined to still go out of business anyway. It can't be fixed that quickly. Now, maybe in the creative destruction, we create new ones, but then that's going to bring a whole risk. Businesses aren't going to get loans at the same terms that we were getting them pre-pandemic. They're going to have to pay higher interest rates or have more stringent covenants on them. And it's going to be a lot harder to start a business than it was before the pandemic. So this is, you know, the damage has been done. And I don't know if we can really undo the damage except for running through an entire economic down cycle.
Yeah, I just don't see how this plays out on the positive side. It may take several years because, as we mentioned, as we're speaking now, when you shut that business down, you have shut down a business. Employees are gone. I was talking to the head of the hotel association, Jim. They said they were operating at 46% capacity. They need about 56% just to break even. And the thing that they're worried about is when the summer vacation season comes to an end, they rely on business travel and conferences when it comes to the fall. I just don't know how many people are going to be going to Vegas for a conference in October if we start another flu season and this thing escalates.
Exactly. When people talk about getting back to normal, I fear that they have a Larry Kudlow definition of getting back to normal. And his definition of getting back to normal is, imagine what it was like in the middle of January 2020 when the stock market was at an all-time high, the economy was doing great. We're going to go right back to that. No, we're not. We're not going to go back to that. We're going to go back to something else, a different type of economy. Different doesn't mean bad, but it does mean changes. And I think like one of the biggest changes is going to be in the form of work from home and business travel. 30% of the workforce in the United States can work from home. I can, you can. We can work from home. The dirty little secret about those 30% that can work from home, the vast, vast majority of them like it and don't want to change it. They're being politically correct when they say, oh, I can't wait back to get back to the office. To the extent, they don't mind going back 1 or 2 days a week, but they don't want to go back 5 days a week, 8 or 9 hours a day is what they don't want to do. That means the real estate business is forever changed. That offices, you can get by with half the office space now because half your workforce will be at home one day. Maybe you switch it up. Others come in the next day and they kind of switch back and forth. You only need half the office space. The business travel is going to change. Leisure travel is going to change. The way that small businesses operate is going to change. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be bad. There will be an adjustment period. But if you're still pining for when is it going to look exactly like January 2020 pre-virus, the answer is it's not. And there's nothing we can do about that. We are going somewhere else. The last thought I'd give you on this is the reason I think that is I've been of the opinion that all of the trends we're seeing, work from home and everything else in the economy during the virus, has been the case that we are accelerating existing trends. Work from home was happening pre-virus. We just made it go a lot faster, maybe light speed faster. We didn't create new things because if we created new things, we would reverse them. That's why I think a lot of these trends are going to be hard to reverse. We like it this way, we being the collective of the 30%, and even the 70% that still have to go in and work like a waitress or something like that, they don't mind it because their commuting times are much less. Their hassle is much less as well, too. If you get all those people, parking is a lot easier. If you get all those people that are working from home that used to have to drive somewhere and park their car and stuff. So, you know, they're even benefiting from it as well, too, in indirect ways.
Let's also talk about something. You mentioned commercial real estate. I've seen several big businesses from Nationwide saying, hey, we don't need as much office space. Let's also talk about another trend that was accelerating and now is accelerating faster. And let's talk about retail. Before the mall shut down this week, I was at a mall last week and it was like a ghost town. I mean, you could park anywhere right up front. Most of the stores, except for some of the big ones like Target and Nordstrom's that were open, the rest of them, they were just boarded up and closed. So let's talk about how retail is going to change, too, the way we shop. I mean, once you get used to ordering stuff online and pressing a button, are you really going to want to go to the malls? And especially some of the risk going to the malls with COVID, and then in some cases, and depending on where you live, some of the violence that was going on at the malls. My sister-in-law works at one in Scottsdale, and when they called her back to work, they had to shut it down because the part of the mall was torched.
Yeah, you know, retailing, brick and mortar retailing has got a real issue on its hands. If you're talking about when we go shopping, I'll put it into two camps. There's what I'll call going to replace inventory. A lot of groceries, a lot of basic necessities that I need to purchase. I know what I want. I just got to get in a car and go get it. Well, I could do that on my phone. I can order that on my phone and get it next day. The other stuff that I want to get by, I need to have the experience of buying it maybe at a mall. You know, one of the last holdouts in brick and mortar retailing might be shoe stores, because for all the movement towards online retailing, everybody likes to put on a pair of shoes in the store and walk around with them for 5 minutes to see if they fit right as well. You know, buying a car, you still want to go through the experience of looking at the car, looking at different colors, test driving a couple of them. You don't want to just go pick one out online. Now, some people do, but I think that for most of us, we do. So retailing is going to have to reimagine itself, to use that Disney term. You know, what is the experience that I am getting by going to your store? The experience. Because if there isn't an experience, I'll just order it on Amazon. But if there is, if there's a desire to want to go to that establishment, it's the same thing that restaurants went through, right? Restaurants are not just food warehouses where you just go get your food. There's the experience of sitting in a restaurant. Well, the retailer is going to have to do the same thing. And I think that they're still struggling to try and figure out how to do that right now and do that in their way. So retailing, there will always be a need for it, just not in the form that we are used to right now. It's going to change. The mall became a thing in the 50s and 60s. It had a good 50, 60 year run. It seems like that's done. Now we're into the process of trying to reimagine the next generation of retailing. I don't have the answer, but I think a lot of retailers are still trying to figure out what it's going to be.
I want to talk about, let's go over to the markets for a minute. And you've got companies like Amazon, Tesla, which is selling at 450 times earnings, reminiscent sometimes. You know, it's been these tech stocks that have been driving a good portion of the market. I want to talk about, you're seeing some stall rates in your economic numbers. We get to October, which normally, typically seasonality-wise, is always a rough time for the market. But I think this year is going to be a little different, Jim, because this is a political election year where you've got two candidates with different philosophies in terms of what they want to do. And right now, it looks like Biden, I agree with you. I think this is going to get to be a tighter race. And I mean, you know, if you looked at the polls in 2016, Hillary Clinton was supposed to be president. That didn't happen. How much do you think this impacts the market as we get closer to the election in October? And let's say that the polls still show Biden is in the lead. What impact?
Yeah, so let me preface these remarks by saying how I'm going to arrive at these conclusions. I pay a lot of attention to the betting markets, the London bookies, predictit.org, you know, the betting sites as well, too. I believe that the betting markets are essentially real-time polls. They take all the information and they aggregate it into one probability. So what am I seeing in that? I'm seeing that Biden has about a, if you go with the polls, let me start there. If you go with the polls, nationally, Biden has about an 8 to 10 point lead over Trump. Now, normally, looking at the history of these markets, I've got the data back to 1988 on all of these betting markets. If any candidate ever got a 10 point lead over another candidate, they'd be trading at about 85 or 90% to win the election. Biden is trading at 60 right now. Why is Biden trading at 60? Because if you go state by state, and remember, we still vote on the Electoral College, about 40 states are done as far as where they're going to go. California is going to vote Democrat. Illinois, where I'm at in Chicago, is going to vote Democrat. Trump can't change that. A lot of the Western states, a lot of the Southern states are going to vote Republican. Biden cannot change that. So this race comes down to 10 states, 10 swing states from Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, you know the drill all the way through. The average lead that Trump has in those 10 swing states is 3% right now. I'm sorry, Biden has in those 10 states is 3%, not 8 to 10 like the national polls do. Reason the national polls show 8 to 10 is because Biden polls plus 25 in California, plus 25 in New York. And that's what gives him that big outsized lead. So it comes down to what's going to happen in those states. And because of that, I think that this election is still open. Trump has still got 100-ish days to basically get everybody enthused about voting for him to the tune of moving those needles by about 3% in those states. Now that I've said that, he's got to execute on that. He was able to do that in 2016. Will he be able to do that in 2020? We'll have to wait and see right now. But I do think it's really going to come down to just a handful of those states. How's it going to affect the markets? I think it's going to affect the markets in a big way, because once you get to November and the markets start viewing the election, the perception is okay, now this is what's going to happen for the economy in 21, 22. We should at that point be somewhat, if not all the way, but somewhat behind on the virus will be behind us at that point. It won't be in front of us anymore. And we've got to start thinking about other effects. As far as to the first part of your question about the mega cap stocks, I will throw out one thing about this market. The five largest stocks, the FANG stocks with Microsoft. So Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft replaced Netflix with Microsoft. At their peak about 2 weeks ago, they were 25% of the S&P 500's market cap, five stocks. Mm. You got to go back to 1964 to find the last time five stocks were that big a concentration in the S&P. The largest stock, Apple, at 6.2%. You got to go back to IBM in 1985 to find the last time that you saw a stock have that big a weighting in the S&P. And finally, 38 stocks as of last week were half the market cap of the S&P. I can't find a time when I could find that few stocks that were half the market cap of the S&P. This is a highly concentrated market in terms of where we're investing. And what is the dominant theme with all those stocks? Is the dominant theme is disruption. They are technology-driven disruptors, and Tesla. Tesla is, what I was going to say about Tesla is also their work-from-home stocks as well, too. A lot of them benefit from work-from-home stocks. Tesla is the exception to the rule as far as the work-from-home thing goes. But Tesla is on a way, on a plane by itself that we've never quite seen. At $300 billion in market cap, Tesla is the largest stock ever to not be in the S&P 500. It's not in the index because it doesn't qualify, because it hasn't turned a four-quarter profit in order to even meet qualification for it. You mentioned it had a 450 PE. Hey, it's positive. That means that they're actually close to starting to turn a profit as well. It used to be a negative because they just didn't have a profit in the past. The E was negative. So that one is a bit of an exception on its own, but this is a highly concentrated work from home type of disruption set of stocks. If the election was to change the views on anybody, if the virus was to change the views on anybody, that in all impacts those stocks, you're going to see it in a big way in the indices.
So given this, let's kind of sum up here. You're starting to see the economy plateau, if not weaken, with some of the numbers that you're following. There's a little bit of disparity also, as you point out, between what we're reporting as the unemployment rate versus what you're seeing in the numbers. Given this uncertainty, and as we've talked about, the damage that's being done to small businesses, and then also the concentration that we're seeing, the disrupting FANG stocks. As an investor, how do you play this with so many ifs? Whether, you know, who becomes president? When does the COVID thing get behind us? What replaces small business? What's the disruption going to look like over the next 2 years? I mean, I have never seen, at least in my career, I don't know about yours, Jim, so many uncertainties that are unknowns right now. What do you do?
Yeah, I agree with you on the uncertainties. Look, when it comes to investing, there's Hugh Hendry once said, you know, there's pontificating and then there's performing. We've largely pontificated about a lot of the issues in the market, and they're real and they're substantive. But then there's performing, and that's when you get into this idea that you've got the central bank and you've got the governments around the world huffing and puffing to push markets higher. You know, I can moralize all I want about how I think that these policies in the long run are bad, and I do. But I will also tell you that in the short run, over the next several months, they're going to work. That's why I've been arguing. I talk negative, but I say at the end of the day, all this money printing is going to continue to work to push markets higher until you start to see the whites of inflation. And that's a 21, maybe a second half of 21 story for the market. So I would say to investors, this is an unusual period. If you want to take a long-term view, you're going to miss out on something because I think the markets are going to go higher. If you want to take that long-term view that there's going to be problems and disruptions, I'm with you on that. But I do think that you have to consider the idea of performance. This is unlike anything we've seen. The standard metrics that people use to invest over the long term, a 5 or 10 year view, I think that's been collapsed. We've seen that in the first 6 months of 2020. You've had you had a historic decline and an historic rebound, all compressed into 6 months is what you've had. So I think you need to adjust accordingly. What I'm trying to say is, I think the money printing is going to push markets higher, maybe for a year, maybe less, but in that range. Once I start to see the whites of inflation, I think that that will overwhelm the money printing and that will be time to get out. I don't see that now, but I do think that it's coming. But since I don't see it now, I think that a long position is the best place to be.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, as we close, tell our listeners about your research report. In my opinion, one of the best research letters in the business.
Thank you very much. I am the president and founder of Bianco Research, LLC. You can find out more about us by going to biancoresearch.com. There's a free trial link. Or you could follow me on Twitter at Bianco Research or on LinkedIn under my name, Jim Bianco. I try to post original content from on a regular basis on social media to give you a flavor of the type of stuff we do.
Well, great work. Well, listen, Jim, thanks for being so generous with your time. Always a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.